Mitzvah Shin Lamed Gimel 333. Shelo Navod Haaretz Bishnas Hayovel. We should not work the land during the Jubilee year. Shelo Navod Haaretz Bishnas Hayovel. Kemoshen Nimnanu Miavodasa Bishnas Hashmita. The same rules apply on the Jubilee year as on the Shemitah year. Shenemar B'Yovel Lo Sizrau. You shall not plant. Kemoshen Nemar B'Shemitah Sad Chalo Sizrau. You shall not plant your fields. It's not specifically planting in the ground, but anything like pruning, things that encourage the trees to sprout, so that's also forbidden. So all these types of working the land or trees are asur on Shemitah, so too they're asur on Yovel. Afikach Amru, Amar, Lo Sizro, Al Haklal, Yichlol, Aretz, Ve'ilan. So I explained the reasoning behind it. It's supposed to give us consciousness about to whom the land really belongs. Exactly the same as Shemitah. That's what we wrote about Shemitah. Remember back in Parshas Mishpatim, if you want, look back. If you don't want, continue on to Mitzvah Shin Lamed Dalet 334. Shelo Niktzor Svichei Tvuos Shel Shnas Hayovel. We should not harvest the stuff that grows on its own, the sproutings of the field during the Yovel year. Shelo Niktzor Vinilkot Svichei Tvuos Shnas Hayovel Kemo Sheadam Kotzer B'Shar Hashanim. Again, on the Daraisa level, the only thing that's forbidden is to harvest the grains and vegetables, things like that, in the same manner that one does in a regular year. You know, you take a combine, you harvest everything, you know, at one time. You just completely lay the whole field bare. But you can do it in an abnormal manner. You could, you know, like, you could pick one watermelon to eat at a time. Or if you have a family, take a few watermelons, you can't like harvest the whole field. Shnemar lo sik tzeru. V'chol inyan kemo shepirashnu v'samloch v'svichei shvias. And they say the rules are the same regarding the svichim of the Shemitah year. And again, the major thing that we know that affects our lives nowadays about the svichim is that there's a rabbinical restriction against consuming the svichim of shvias, and presumably of Yovel as well, although by the time the Chachamim made this rule, there was no more Yovel, was not no longer observed. But when Yovel is restored, it's Hashem speedily b'mehira v'yameinu, so we will have this restriction as well on Yovel, unless the Sanhedrin, I guess, at the defense reconstituted, decides to rescind this prohibition. Yeah.
And we discussed actually there are two ways of
v'chol inyan kibo shepirashnu v'samoch v'svichei shvies. And the whole idea is, yeah, exactly as explained by the Svicha Vashvias. Fine. Mitzvah Shilamed Hei, 335. Shelo Lesov Peros Vailanos Mishnas Yovel Kederach Shosinos and Bishar Shanim. So you're not allowed to harvest the fruits of the trees in the same way one does in a normal year. Shelo Neso Peros Vailanos Mishnas Yovel Kederach Shosinos and Bishar Shanim. That we should not collect the fruit of the trees on during the Jubilee year as we do it on the rest of the year. Shenemar Below siv tzeru as nezireha, you shall not harvest the set aside plantings, the vineyards. And again, we had the whole disagreement between Rashi and the Ramban as to exactly what that meant. But back in Shvias, back when we were discussing Shvias, who has hara derech klal l'chol peros ilan. So it's talking about not just grapes, but any tree fruits. V'izir akazu biyovel peros ilan azhara bifnei atzma v'tuas azhara bifnei atzma. That Torah says it's a specific prohibition regarding vegetables and grains on the one hand, the svichim and the fruits on the other hand. K'mo b'shvias, k'mo shekasavnu l'mal, again to emphasize the prohibition. V'adin b'shneyem k'lomar b'shmitu biyovel b'la v'nil echadu, the theme is the same. V'mishorsh echad yale akol l'fi adome, the reasoning is the same, the reasoning behind it. Vein sarech laharech al kulan, and I have to explain myself again and again after at each time. Vargasavti ki kol ze einu noeg ela ba'aretz only in Eretz Yisrael. Val tanai shu kol yoshvei aleha, the all the tribes of the Jewish people are dwelling in the land of Israel, in their places. Ve'akol sheva v'sheva dar bimkomo, at the correct nachala. Okay, that's it for Yovel for now, but now we're going on a excursion, which is Chosh and Mishpatik. It's regarding Jewish civil procedures, which is a change of pace from what we were talking before, which was the Jewish agricultural laws, but it has a lot of relevance to what we do nowadays, as opposed to the Oval, which does not. Mitzvah Shin Lamed Vav, 336. Mitzvah Asiyas Din Bein Lokeach Umocher. The mitzvah to adjudicate properly between one who's making a purchase and one who's making a sale. It's a separate, it's a mitzvah to do it according to the way it says in the Torah. Shenadin bedin mekach umemkar, ginyan shetziv sohat Torah alav. That regarding sales, we should do it the way the Torah says. Kolomar sheish tzadim sheish kaima mecher, bein mocher lokech, veish tzadim she'ein lokiyum. That there are ways, there are methods of acquisition that work, and there are methods of acquisition that don't work. So one method of acquisition that does not work at all is verbal. If I say, Harry, I want to sell you my phone, and you say, yes, I would like to purchase your phone, and even if we have witnesses here who stated, who can testify that we stated it at absolute with absolute seriousness, nevertheless, the transaction is absolutely invalid. There's no halachic status of that transaction, and therefore, I could go afterwards and say, "Haha, just kidding. I want my phone," and and in fact, not transfer it into Harry's possession at all. That's just one example of a kinyan that doesn't work. Well, here we'll be talking mostly about kinyan that do work.
So wait, so the edim, so they just have no standing?
No, edim are not required. When a method of acquisition that does work is employed, so edim are not required.
So therefore, when
I was just using the example, what?
So therefore, in this case, so therefore they're irrelevant if they're not required.
I was just using an example that even if they were edim that heard a say very seriously, they give it extra, you know, solemnity.
Right. In other words, definitely nobody questions
right.
that these words were exchanged.
No, I mean, edim are necessary when you have, you know, two people who contradict each other as to whether a sale actually took place. But if two people come to Beis Din and you say, I sold this, and yes, you sold it to me, and they agree, they're just, you know, dealing with the details, then the transaction is valid if one of the correct methods of acquisition was employed. We have to adjudicate according to the Torah between them. There are other times where this was stated in the Torah. Again, that discuss how trials are supposed to take place with each other. So let's say it's not an issue of a transaction per se, but rather someone claims he was owed money for a different reason or that somebody damaged his property. So we have all these types of things that the Torah tells us that we have to adjudicate properly. So you could say that transactions, acquisitions, are just a subcategory of other claims that one could have against another. So he says, one person says, oh, I borrowed money from you, or you borrowed money from me. So, okay, so another way that another person could owe money is that, oh, I sold this to you, but you didn't pay me properly, something like that. So he says that even though sales could be included as a subcategory of toin v'nitan, which means that people have claims against each other, nevertheless, afal pichein, ba ha-mitzvah in ha-mekach v'memkar miuchedes mipnei shudavar tamidi el habrios, that God wants to address as specifically as possible with mitzvos things that are really necessary. You know, there's a concept, lahagdil Torah al-hadir, that sometimes, even though things are not absolutely necessary, they're included in the Torah just to round it out. Something like that. That's why, the Torah tells us that the only fish, the sea creatures that we're allowed to eat are ones that have fins and scales. So the Gemara says, why is it necessary to say fins and scales? All fish that have scales also have fins. So I need the fins. And the answer is lahagdil Torah al-hadir. You want to round out the discussion. You don't want to give skimpy details. You want to make it nice and fleshed out. So the same thing too here. We want to flesh it out, and we want to discuss the methods of acquisition explicitly. She'iyav shalivnei adam lichyos afil yom echad zuloso. That society could not function even one day without addressing correctly the methods of acquisition. And since it's so common, you don't want people to say, oh, what's the... Then here, oh, that's just sort of alluded to in the Torah. It's not discussed explicitly. It's just a subcategory. Oh, since it's something that's so frequent, we want to be able to reference the Torah's view on it explicitly. This is how the Torah works in many places. If something is very necessary or very stringent, then the Torah wants to discuss it explicitly. And sometimes the Torah repeats itself. So let's say the same prohibition many times, or the same mitzvah many times, in order to make clear how serious it is. How many times does the Torah prohibit idolatry? Not exactly idolatry, but any worship besides of God. How many times? In 44 places in the Torah, it says you're not allowed to worship Avodah Zarah. So the Torah singles out explicitly the worship of Molech a couple times, because Molech was one of the most common Avodah Zarahs, and the Torah again wanted to address it explicitly so people shouldn't have to even deduce. The Torah commands us to keep Shabbos 12 times in the Torah. But is Yachad Azarabo Biktsas Melachos, the Torah mentions certain melachos explicitly, Kimo Havara Vehotza, that the melachos that are extremely common, one is kindling. Again, if you think about, if certain types of lights nowadays are not technically under the category of Havara on a Daraisa level, fine, okay. But even so, just think of how common it is conceptually. Nowadays, if we were to consider we had incandescent lights still, you walk into a room, you turn on the light, you walk into another room, you turn on the light, you want to cook something, so you turn on a fire. So that's an extremely common daily activity that's prohibited on Shabbos. That's why the Torah explicitly mentions that lighting a fire is something that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. The Torah mentions also, again, not explicitly exactly, but when it says in the Chumash, Al yetze ish mimakomo b'yom ha-shvi, that nobody should leave their place on the seventh day. So the Sefer HaChinuch, actually, when we were learning it back in Parshas B'Shalach, the Sefer HaChinuch adopted the position of the Rambam and other Rishonim that the verse is actually talking about the prohibition of tchumen, the Sabbath limit beyond which you're not allowed to walk. Something we don't even think about nowadays because we all live in. Although I guess technically,
it's a Russian bridge,
right?
Well, no, the going to Riverdale question.
Right.
Going to Riverdale is a question. That's true. The truth is that in Manhattan, because we're surrounded by rivers, which cuts off the city, so then people think about Truman perhaps a little bit more. But in many metropolitan areas where you don't have rivers in the middle necessarily, or at least not wide rivers that could really cut the Trum. So, or you live in a vast suburban sprawl, who even thinks about Truman? It's not even an issue.
Nobody ever walked that far. They take a car or
something. Okay. Although you actually find, it was interesting, one time we were in the Catskills last summer, and in the hotel we were staying at, they had a map in the lobby of the Trum. To walk past the Seren Shabbat.
Right.
It really is relevant. Okay. Yeah. But the tchum that's prohibited midaraisa, if there is such a thing as tchum and midaraisa, which is a major machlokes, is not the tchum that we think of 2,000 amos, but only 12,000 amos. So it's six times as large, the tchum, if there is a daraisa. Everybody agrees that the tchum of 2,000 amos is only the rabbana. But whatever it is, so the chinuch says that even included in that, even if it's really explicitly talking about the tchum, nevertheless, there's an allusion in that mitzvah. It's a reference also to the prohibition of carrying, of transferring objects on Shabbos from an enclosed area to an unenclosed area. Vine, which is also obviously the most common melacha that people do. People are not Shomer Shabbos, Rachman Alitzan, or people, if you have an area with an Erev, and you have people who don't use the Erev, and you have people who do use the Erev, so just think about if you look in the eyes of people who do use the Eruv, look it from the eyes of people who don't use the Eruv to the eye, to looking at people who do use the Eruv, so that's by far the most common malacha that people could possibly be doing. If they carry something in your pocket outside, you have your keys, you have 50, could go be you could violate the malacha vatsa 50 times a day. The other malachos are, again, there are common ones, but those are particularly common. So there's a disagreement in the Gemara about what the Torah means when it tells us that it tells us explicitly that you're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. So does it mean that it's telling you that you receive the penalty for violating Shabbos for each malacha individually, even if you do many of them over the course of Shabbos? Or does it mean that the prohibition of lighting a fire on Shabbos is not included in the general prohibition of doing malach on Shabbos, which is punishable by karis and skila, and it would only be alav, so it would only be punishable by malchus? There's disagreement in the Gemara as to what this means. We paskin havar l'lav yatzas, havar l'chalik yatzas. Paskin that havara, the fact that Torah singles out havara means that you get the penalty for each malacha individually, and in fact, if you did light a fire on Shabbos, so you would be subject to the penalty of karis and skila. So the Sefer Chinuch says, well, what do you mean? So if I'm telling you that the Torah just repeats things or singles things out because it likes singling things out occasionally, when it's a very common thing, lahagdil Torah lahadir. So how could the interpretation here be either that l'chalik yotzas or l'lav yotzas? So that the Rechinuch answer is Eina Midrash Lanu Stira Harbe Panim LaTorah. So there could be, the Torah could have had many things in mind by singling out the Havara explicitly, and it, just because that the exact halacha conclusion that Chazal derive from it is not exactly what the concept I'm trying to tell you now. He's saying it doesn't matter because the Torah can be interpreted in different ways. Shorish Adinin Yadua Ki Udavar Shesechel B'nei Ish Meid Olav U'Mavakish Oso. That you have to have order between the way people conduct transactions, because if there were no rules, then everybody just did what they wanted, and every court passed in the way they wanted, so then it would be a major problem. So there are different ways to conduct an acquisition in halacha, depending on what is being acquired. Shehakarkos v'ho'avodim, that real estate and slaves, there's a hekesh between slaves and real estate, so even though slaves are movable property, nevertheless, we treat slaves the same way as land. So niknin b'kesef b'shtar uvachazoka. There are three ways to do it. One is kesef, that if I pay you for your land, so the minute my money touches your hand, the property becomes mine. Another way is by a document, that even if I don't pay you at all and the document is worth nothing, just on a piece of paper, or worth a quarter of a cent, so I write on the paper, my field is sold to you, I give you the shtar, and then that would be another method of acquisition. Another method is chazaka, which is that you act like an owner. That let's say you sell a house and the buyer takes the keys and locks the door, then that would be considered a method of acquisition and the sale would be final. How does that apply to slaves? If you work the slave, so A sells B a slave, and then B says, take off my shoes. That's the example I was given. Take off my shoes for me. So then that's the chazaka of the slave, and then the slave would be completely his. How exactly these work? This is discussed at length in the first parak of Maseches Kiddushin. But what about movable property objects? There are different ways that those are acquired. Some are acquired by lifting it up. That's a transaction we're all very familiar with. That is the strongest method of acquisition. It works for anything. and it works anywhere, as we're going to see. V'yesh mehen sheniknim b'kniya pechusa mizo v'hi ha-meshicha. There are some that are acquired by pulling, by, you know, just even if you don't lift it up, so just that would work. Not, I mean, it wouldn't work on a phone, but you got the idea. U'mehen sheniknim b'pechusa mizo v'hi ha-mesira. There are some that are acquired not that don't even require the buyer to pull the object, to move it, but rather just, for example, handing part of the object from one person to the other would work. So he's going to give the example later of selling a very large object like a ship. So you don't have to pull the ship. That would be difficult unless you actually want it to go to sea. So you just, you know, sort of grab onto it. Fine. So the Chazal bring a proof that these objects require these methods of acquisition, and you don't just acquire them like you do real estate. That's the pasuk in the parsha, Parsha's Bahar, where the Sefer Chinuch is basing himself on, that there is a Torah rule of Mekach u'Memcher, how to conduct an acquisition, which is interesting, which he doesn't bring this verse in the beginning. Usually the first thing he says is, the mitzvah is so-and-so, because it says in the pasuk this and that. But here he waits until over here in order to tell us this. So, o kano miyada misech, or buying from your friend. Again, it doesn't, it's not an explicit command in the Torah, but the Torah references the idea of purchasing, so there must be a Torah rule behind it. That there's a different method of acquisition for something that can be handed from hand to hand, whereas real estate cannot be handed from hand to hand, and we know we have a hekesh from real estate to slaves. And the delineation of these three methods of acquisition for real estate and slaves is based on verses in Nevi'im, where it talks about selling property. Was one place where it talks about with a safer hamikna, another place where it talks about buying with money, and again another place where it talks about acting like an owner towards the property. Kemo Shabbat B'Sham Kiddushin, it's all explained in detail in Maseches Kiddushin on Daf Chavav. Ve'in Sof Ve'keilu Akneos Kulan Mitakonas Chachomim Ein. Even though he's going on and telling you that, you know, we're trying to derive the Torah's rule of Mekach U'Memkar here, he says, no, these methods of acquisition are Derabanan. Ve'eviu Aksuvim L'smoch Bahen Divrehem. That's not telling you that the Torah actually allows these and only these methods of acquisition for these objects, but rather it's all the Rabbanan, the Chachamim instituted of how to do these things. Well, yeah.
I'm just confused. I mean, you either own something or don't. You can't say I own it, you know, Rabbanan, but not Daraisa. I mean, how can you say that?
You can.
Oh, really?
First of all, that is a huge machlokes as to whether, let's say, it was Chazal who instituted the kinyan of Mesira. Mm-hmm. So let's say you transfer a ship by way of Mesira. So does that mean, and you haven't paid for it yet, we'll see later that paying is the main thing, Daraisa. So you haven't paid for it yet, at least part of a down payment. So does that mean that if you transfer ownership of a ship by way of Mesira, you only own the ship Derabanan? There are people who say that. There are people who say you only own the ship Derabanan. But they're saying that, no, the Torah doesn't mean that it's davka buying by money that acquires. It means even buying by money. So there could be other methods of acquisition that would be effective.
I mean, what are the consequences of owning something Derabanan as opposed to Raisa?
Kiddushin. Let's say you acquire a ring, mm-hmm, for a wedding. Let's say you don't pay for it, but rather you only perform hagbah on the, mm-hmm, ring. You don't, mm-hmm, pay for it at all. So then, use it to marry a woman. So therefore, it's possible that the kiddushin would only be derabanan, mm-hmm, in such a situation. And it doesn't sound right. Mm-hmm. We don't want that to be the case, but okay. But that's why there are certain Yeah, that's why they say you should make sure when you're buying a wedding ring. So you're supposed to make sure to pay money for it. You should actually pay money, and then you can perform the rabban and the kinyan. But it's important to get money for it.
Wait, credit card's okay? Don't
yeah, credit card's okay because he accepts that in place of cash. Right,
yeah. Yeah. But you can't then use an somebody inherited from your family or whatever.
So I did actually. I used an inherited ring, which I believed belonged to my, I'm pretty sure, 99% sure, belonged to my father's mother. He was the only child, so he definitely inherited it. He was the only person to inherit it. So I paid him money. I paid him $1 or something for the ring. And just in case we misidentified the original owner, so I paid my mother as well. In case it was a family heirloom in her family, I paid my father $1, paid my mother $1. And then I performed the methods of the Rabbanan methods of acquisition. If somebody gives explicit permission for one of their objects to be used as Kiddushin, so that's considered to be an absolute matana. Oh. It's considered to be an absolute matana because you assume that if the explicit intent is to use it for Kiddushin, so then therefore that would the meaning is the wife is going to get it. They're not going to give it back. It's going to be hers.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. But so it's not like the famous case of like say so they can't find the ring, so they ask some married woman at the over at the wedding to say, can we use your ring for the kedushin.
You could that. You should pay her.
Okay. Good. Okay. Right. Yeah.
Pay her. So at least the symbolic amount. Pay her $1 for the ring. Then you make hagbah, and then you can use it. Mm-hmm. But again, make her a din.
Then give it back, or then you don't.
You don't have to give it back.
It's not. It's bad manners not to.
Right. You don't have to give it back, yeah. But, yeah. But technically, like I said, technically, if a woman, or whoever it is, gave you a ring and said, here, I'm lending this to you in order for you to perform Kiddushin, then the intent is that it's going to be a real gift because you intend for it to be used for Kiddushin. Okay. But, yeah, so that was a situation where we actually did use a family heirloom in order to do Kiddushin. But most people just go to the store and buy a ring, so then they just pay money and they get it's not wrong. So use this one. But again, all those things again were strictly speaking. I mean, some of them were should be done the chatchila, but. So if all these things are derabanan, so how can they bring biblical verses as proof for what they're saying? This is the famous issue of asmachta. So a lot of times, Chazal will say, oh, this rule is derived from such and such a verse. And then, either they state explicitly or the implication is it's just an asmachta. It's just a peg for the rabbinical rule, but it's not really considered to be a full biblical deoraisa rule. So what's pshat with that? How could they find suggestions for what they say in the Bible if it's not a real biblical rule? So there are two approaches. One approach is that really the biblical verse has absolutely nothing to do with this. Mm-hmm. Has no shaykhs whatsoever. And Chazal just wanted to attach their rules to things that are sort of suggested in biblical verses in order to help people remember it. Mm-hmm. Or to connect their words more with more with the Torah. But that's not the way that the Sefer HaChinuch is going. The Sefer HaChinuch says, no. The Avabi Sheker Aksuvim Eino Al osan asmachtos nilmados hemitochan. The pshat in asmachta is much deeper. The pshat in asmachta is that God really wanted Chazal to impose these restrictions or to create these rules, but for whatever reason, God didn't want it to be an absolute deraisa thing right off the bat. So therefore, God incorporated allusions to the to things that he thought were proper to be done, but didn't want to require immediately, so that Chazal would be able to derive their rules and attach them to these verses. So again, the difference hashkafically is whether these rabbinical rules have a divine stamp on them, or just in terms of what they are exactly. Or are they just regular rabbinical prohibitions that were completely invented by the sages, which God obviously requires us to adhere to as well, but didn't necessarily allude to explicitly with the divine mind?
So it's not like a different intermediate level between Drabbana and Daraisa, like such as you know, like Sofrim or,
This wouldn't be an intermediate. It would be a Din Darabanan. All the rules that govern it would be those of a Din Darabanan. But, when each rabbi who came up with his rule, I mean, we don't really use this machtas anymore, but I'm saying in the olden days when the Chachamim were creating the rules and using asmachtas, so they get up to Shamayim and God is going to give them, Shkoyach, Shkoyach, this is what I meant. I wanted you to do this. I included this in the Torah for this reason, and good job. As opposed to just like, okay, you invented your rules. Okay, good. Fine. That's what you're supposed to do.
Now, are smachtas only from the Chumash, or they can also...
No, they can be the whole Tanakh. Yeah. These rules that are found in the Gemara and Kiddushin, the smachtas is about how the transactions work, are found in Nach. The Amru, Zichrono Levracha, of a Gemara, Dvar Torah, Mos Konos Af B'Mitaltalin, on a Daraisa level, the way you conduct any transaction is through money. So Harry says to me, I want to buy your phone. He gives me a quarter. The quarter reaches my hand. Now the phone is his. Even if it's still, sitting right here, it's in my pocket maybe still, but Al Pidin, the phone is absolutely his on a Daraisa level.
Even if you want to sell it for more than a quarter?
Well, you have to pay the rest.
Right. Okay.
But it becomes absolutely yours.
It's like a down payment.
Right, it's like a down payment, right. Right, it can't go back. In other words, if you don't have the money to pay the rest, then you have to pay me the rest somehow, but you don't have to give me back the phone. You could sell your car and you could pay me the rest of the money for the phone. You could, if you want, give me the phone back in order to pay your debt, but the phone in the meantime would absolutely belong to you. And, that's on a deraisa level. Aval tam... Oh, this is machlokas, by the way. This is the famous machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan, who usually Paskin like, says that on a deraisa level, the money affects the acquisition, but Reish Lakish says, no, on a deraisa level, you need meshicha as well. You need to pull it into, at least a little bit to show possession of it. We pass like Rabbi Yochanan. Aval tam hitzricham hamashicha bahen gzeira shema yomar lo mocher lo kech nisrifu chitecha ba'aliya. That, let's just imagine how it would work if Mos Konos. So I have an attic filled with wheat. And now Harry says, he gives me a quarter. And he says, I want to buy your wheat. I said, fine. So he gives me the quarter. Now my whole attic full of wheat now belongs to him. And then, whoops, so now it's Harry's. So Harry says, okay, I'm going to come pick it up on Monday. Okay, he'll come pick it up on Monday. So in the meantime, I'm not really so concerned about my attic because now it belongs to someone else. So then I see that, it seems to be, it smells a little like gas in the attic and... something seems fishy, but whatever is Harry's problem, he'll take care of it when he comes tomorrow, because now he owns the wheat. But lo and behold, there's a spark, and there's actually a gas leak, and it ignites all the wheat in the attic, and it's destroyed. So Harry comes to me, and he says, I want my money back. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean your money back? It's yours. Sorry. You have to pay me the rest of the money, not just I'm not giving you your quarter back. You have to pay me the rest of the money, because you purchased all this wheat from me, and it's your wheat that got destroyed. So in order to prevent such a situation from happening, Chazal instituted that they needed other types of kinyanim. So, let's say a different illustration, slightly different illustration, which is that I harvested my wheat, and I said, Harry, can I put them in your attic? So Harry says, sure, you can store your wheat in my attic. But then Harry, is passing by this wheat every day, it smells really good, and Harry wants to purchase the wheat. So I said, fine, I'm willing to sell you my wheat, so give me a quarter as a down payment. So Harry gives me a quarter, he does not have to do any method of acquisition because they're in his property already. So when it's in his property already, so mos konos, even if, says the Sefer Chinuch, even if Harry owns the attic, but I've rented the attic as a storage space, rented the attic itself, nevertheless, since it belongs to him fundamentally, even though it's rented to me, then the acquisition is completed immediately when Harry gives me the money. And the reason behind this is that since it's in Harry's property, whether it's rented or not, then he can keep his eye on it, so we won't have this issue of the seller not taking proper care of the objects because, hey, it's already his, so who cares if it gets destroyed, yeah?
No, sure. It's not that they...
But if he did Hagbah, for example, if he came at the Matic and did Hagbah on each bag of wheat, then too bad. So he's displayed his intention, hey, I'm acquiring them and I'm leaving them here. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then it's not my fault if I don't watch them properly.
Okay.
The same thing. If the purchaser just has this area rented, so the same thing over here. That again, even if he doesn't own it, but anyway, that he has some control over this area. So then, simply money would work. The amru gamkein shakarka niskar im advarim shehu nilkach. So real estate can be rented with the methods that it is purchased as well. Again, that's the money and the document and the acting owner, like an owner. That lending is sort of like a minor sale. It's a temporary sale. Not exactly, but a similar concept. The amru gamkein kishem shemekomo shel adam konelo kach kelav konelo b'chol makom shielo rishus lahaniach oso. So if something falls into your vessel, so then that is also a method of acquisition, assuming that you have permission to place your vessels there. What does that mean? So once the object that's being acquired is inside the vessel, then they cannot rescind the transaction. It's as if they did hagbah, or it was placed in the house of the owner, I mean the purchaser. So you can't, let's say you have a suitcase and you want the suitcase to acquire something on your behalf. So if the suitcase is on Broadway, in the middle of Broadway, so you have no right to put your suitcase there. So let's say if the purchaser, you know, drops the object in the suitcase, then the suitcase would not acquire the object for you. So one of the examples of a place where not leave your suitcase is if you're in the seller's house. The seller is selling some clothing, and the purchaser brings in his suitcase to schlep the clothing back to his house. So he just leaves the suitcase on the floor, and the owner, the seller, drops the clothing into the suitcase while it's still in the seller's house. So that's not an absolute acquisition, because that's another example of a place where the purchaser does not have the right to place his objects. So again, this could only apply in a place where the purchaser has a right to place his objects. However, if you're going to a yard sale and the purchaser says to the seller, oh, this is a lovely suitcase, beautiful suitcase. So the purchaser, so the seller says, okay, fine, you know, give me a dollar, it's yours, fine. So he purchased the suitcase, he lifted up the suitcase, now the purchaser completely owns the suitcase, but he left it right in the smack in the middle of the yard sale. So he doesn't really have permission to leave the suitcase there, but if later he finds something else he likes at the yard sale, a trinket, and he puts the trinket into the suitcase, since the suitcase was purchased at that time, so that's considered to be, he has rishus to leave the suitcase there, and anything placed inside it will be absolutely purchased because it was purchased, again, at that exact time. It wasn't something he just brought in and left there randomly. Because in such a situation, the seller doesn't mind that the suitcase, even though it technically belongs to someone else, is being left in the middle of his yard sale because he's just happy to get rid of it. He's just happy that it was purchased. It's as if the suitcase were in the property of the purchaser. The mesira ain't okay. There's a different type of kinyan called mesira. Sheina mesira kona ella birshus rabim uvachotzer sheina shel shnehem. So kinyan mesira, which is a weaker type of kinyan, only works in the public domain or in a courtyard which doesn't belong to the two of them. The kinyan mesira hu b'mashe ein derech b'nei adam l'rov godlan lagbian velo afilu lemoshchan. So it's something you can't really lift up, and it's something you can't even really pull. So you want to sell a ship. So again, a little ship, you could pull, like a canoe. A canoe you could purchase with Hagbar Meshicha. Again, it's possible to move them, but it would be extremely difficult. So therefore, you would not be allowed to... You would be allowed to use just Mesira by handing it over, but that would only work in Rishus Rabbim. If you went to the docks, again, it doesn't mean a technical Rishus Rabbim like for Shabbos, it just means any public area. So, like, you would have to go to the docks together and you say, "Hey, I want to buy your boat." And you say, "Okay," so you hand over the boat, grab onto it, and that would be good. Ha-Meshicha ein akein. Shein ha-Meshicha o-Sekinyin ela besimta. So Meshicha, which is a slightly stronger type of kinyan, so that only works in a side alley. So if you have a side alley, even though the area doesn't belong to you, but it's assumed that people will leave their stuff there. It's not like the middle of Broadway, that if people leave their stuff, you know, by the A-train. So the A-train, they have that little library thing there. They have those books there. So I don't think anybody has permission to put it there, but nobody really cares that it's there because it's not really in the way. So therefore, something like that, again, I don't know if that technically qualifies for this, but something like that, like a side area, so Meshicha does work. So if you put your stuff there, so whoever gets there first gets to leave their stuff there, and another person has no right to remove the stuff. So in such a place, Meshicha would work. It works in a courtyard that belongs to both of them. But lifting up works in all places, which is why we like to use the strong kinyan of hagba whenever possible. So it's like, you know, your body you own in any place. You have a right to put your body anywhere. I mean, not literally, but you can walk in Rishus Rabim. So if it's literally in your hand and you lift up the object, so that's considered to be as if it's in your possession in any place. V'yesh od kinya acheres b'karkos u'metaltel in Dvar Torah. This is a Torah-level kinyan. V'hi achalifin. A transaction of exchange. This was the normal method of transaction formerly in Israel. Where's that phrase borrowed from?
From Rus.
What does it say? That people would remove their what?
Shoes.
Does it mean shoes? Zefer Chinuch says, he quotes it later, that maybe it doesn't really mean a shoe, it means a glove. Make a little cleaner. The transaction over here, that is not actually a shoe, it's a glove. And how do you say, a glove basically is a shoe for a hand. How do you say glove in German?
Handshoe.
Yeah, it's a hand shoe. And literally in English, the hand shoe. V'inyan achalifin hu sha'adam machlif behemto bevemas chaveiro. So let's say you want to exchange animals. I want your cow and you want my donkey. Okli bichli, you want my phone and I want your pot. Okelim bekarkos, or you want my land and I want your car. V'amru chachamim b'chol elu shekevan shemashach ha'echad ha'kli mechavero zocha chavero be'oso ha'kli, yeah?
Now, I'm the impression, at least, that say in the diamond business, back when from Jews installed in the diamond business, that a transaction would be affected by shaking hands and saying mazel and bracha. Now, how is that possible? All right, or in fact, why wouldn't they at least institute that you should do some kind of Kenyan cleavage, something of that sort, or,
It's a good question. Why not make it more in line with what the Torah says? But there is a principle in Choshe Mishpat type of rules in general that, again, when it's not an absolute contradiction to a rule, obviously, but minag mivatal halacha. That doesn't mean that any custom can cancel out a halacha. That's not what it means. What it means is when there's a type of monetary standard, or what's called in halacha kinyan situmta. A situmta means a normal method of transaction that's acceptable in that place and time. So the Torah does recognize, to a certain extent, that as a valid kinyan. So to a certain extent, if the convention is a certain way and everybody recognizes that, then you don't necessarily even need these explicit rules.
So even when you have like a Chinese dealer selling it to an Indian, they say Muslim brocha, apparently so.
Well, okay, but I mean, they have their own standards, whatever.
Or I could email you the money.
What do you mean? Email that's Mo's. If I accept that in terms of as an actual payment, so that...
So long as I don't have to actually hand you, currency, I can...
Or
no, but that's currency. That's what I'm saying. That's the equivalent of currency.
Or credit
so that's not an absolute Kenyan. Mm-hmm. That for sure wouldn't be an absolute Kenyan. You need some more direct method of transaction. Yeah, that's why we've been talking about mechiras chametz. So one of the things that you do when you're selling the chametz to a non-Jew, because there's a shayla about exactly what types of kinyanim work with non-Jews. All that we're talking about over here is transactions between Jews. So what types of kinyanim work between Jews and non-Jews? So it's very unclear. The only thing that works for sure is if the non-Jew pays money and brings it home. That's the only thing that's absolutely 100% certain to be a valid transaction between a Jew and a non-Jew. So that's why some people, with their chametz, they don't go to the rabbi to sell their chametz. They pack up all their chametz into a box, and they go to their neighbor, they knock on the door and say, here, would you like to buy this? And you know the drill. We, feel free, obviously, there's no restrictions on you using it now, but, you know the drill that usually what's left I'm willing to take back after Pesach. And the non-Jew says, sure, gives money, takes the object, brings it into his apartment, and that's it. That's absolutely valid mechiras chametz. It's not a question whatsoever, at least on a deraisa level. But the most people don't want to do that. Most people want to just keep the chametz in their homes, and they put it aside, and they don't want to have to go through with the hassle. And a non-Jew doesn't want to go through the hassle of collecting all this merchandise and putting it into his own warehouse. So that's why... Basically, the way Mechiras Chametz is you try lots of different kinyanim and you hope one of them works. So that's why you have, when you do Mechiras Chametz, so you do Mos, he pays, makes a down payment with money, and he does a shtar, he uses a shtar, he rents the land, and he acquires the Chametz along with the land. That's called Kinyan Agav. And they do, one of the kinyanim is Situmta. Which is, you shake the rabbi, who's the emissary of all these people, shakes hands with the non-Jew and says, mazel bracha, basically. We shake hands, and then the non-Jew says, the deal is done. So shaking hands and saying, the deal is done, is a accepted method of acquisition in 21st century America, apparently. That's how business deals are done, shaking hands. And that's one of the methods that they do in order to sell the chametz. Okay, so there is a recognition in the Torah for this this type of kinyan of situmta. V'amru chachamim b'chol elu shekevan shemoshach ha'echad akli mechaveru zocha chaveru bosu akli ha'acher shu rotza liknoso mimenu b'chol makom sheyeh. So even you could do a chalifin, which is done as follows. So let's say I want to buy Harry's donkey, and he wants to buy my phone. So we go to a place where Meshicha works, and Meshicha is a Kenyan that works on small animals. So I take the reins of the donkey, and I pull it four amos. That's the Kenyan Meshicha. And at that point that I acquire the donkey by Meshicha, so even though the phone is still in my pocket, Harry hasn't done anything, he hasn't paid, he hasn't done anything. So he completely acquires the phone. B'imyera bo shum aveda, and if the phone gets lost, nevad letzorach zeh shezocha bo achsho b'chalifin. So too bad, so if the phone gets destroyed or stolen or whatever, so then Harry is at a loss, and he just has to deal with the amount of money that he lost with the phone.